Navolutions with Dr. J, your source for time-tested and cutting-edge natural medicine approaches to optimize your health, with your host, Dr. J. Sordian.
All right, this is exciting. So this is Natural Solutions with Dr. J. I'm Dr. J. Sordian, and I'm very pleased today to have the honor to interview Julie Motz. Julie and I met over the internet, and in getting to know each other a little bit, I discovered that she is an author and an energy coach, is it?
An energy healer.
Energy healer. And the book that she wrote, Hands of Life. Hands of Life, is a very, very fascinating title. And the background behind it is very, very, very interesting as well. Energy healer, I met many energy healers in my time, but someone who has experience in doing energy healing before, during, and after heart surgeries and all is something extremely unique. Extremely unique. So that really caught my attention.
And I'm so sorry that it's unique, because I hope that after my book came out that the operating rooms of America would be flooded with healers, and it didn't happen.
Oh, no. Well, maybe this podcast will help that happen. So, and you are also,
I have a weekly radio show. Sometimes I do science and technology, and sometimes I do entertainment and the arts.
Fantastic. So, and that's a local?
It's on KWMR.
KWMR.
Our studio is in Point Reyes Station, but if you're not driving around West Marin, you can also listen online.
Okay, perfect. And so that's KWMR?
Yeah, .org.
.org, excellent, excellent. And what's the name of the program?
Well, sometimes it's called Arts Desire, and sometimes it's called Hot Tech Cool Science. Yeah, depending on what subject.
Or Arts Desire.
Yeah.
Oh, nice names. Nice names. You came up with those?
Yes, I did.
And how long has that been for?
About 15 years.
15. Yeah. Fantastic. Fantastic. And so, tell me something about the book and the experience behind it.
Okay. Well, the book mostly describes my work in surgery, my work as a healer in surgery, preparing people for surgery, helping them recover from surgery. But it also has some of my ideas about health in general, healing in general, emotions, and the role they play in health and healing. But it came primarily out of my experience at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center, now New York Presbyterian Medical Center, and mostly with the now nefarious Dr. Mehmet Oz.
Oh, is that right? Oh.
Yes, who was the youngest surgeon on the cardiothoracic service when I was there. And what happened was I was getting a master's in public health.
Oh, right.
I was trying to transition from my wild, unremunerative life as a documentary filmmaker, which I'd done for 23 years.
Documentary filmmaker?
Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Into a life as a healer. But somehow I thought I would penetrate the healthcare system and convert it to alternative medicine. And the route to doing this would be to get a master's in public health.
Very interesting strategy.
Of course, 2 weeks after my enrollment at the Columbia School of Public Health, I realized I would need at least a PhD, and I was barely going to make it through the master's program. Not because it was academically hard, but because it felt tedious and irrelevant. But anyway, there I was, you know. And at the time, someone had given Columbia a huge amount of money to start a center for alternative and complementary medicine.
This was when?
This was back in 1993.
1993.
But Columbia was very afraid to spend this money. And they tried to get an MD to run it, and they couldn't get anybody. So instead they got a woman with a PhD who was much lower in the pecking order at the health sciences campus, unfortunately. So they didn't initially want her to spend money on anything, so she started by sending out a survey to the entire health science campuses about alternative medicine. And the ones that came back where people admitted they had dealings with alternative medicine were sent back anonymously.
So interesting. So no one wanted to cop to the fact that they had...
But a few days after the survey went out, I got a call from her, and she said, cardiothoracic surgery is interested.
Oh.
I didn't know exactly what that meant, but I knew they were a major profit center for the hospital. So I said, this is wonderful. They have more money than God. You know, we'll travel all around the world. We'll do a feasibility study. We'll put Dean Ornish to shame. You know, I said,
is that what you were thinking?
That's what I was thinking.
Okay.
So she said, she said, I don't have time to deal with this, Julie. I said, okay, who's the contact person? She said, it's this guy, Mehmet Oz. And here's his phone number. So I call up and I get Dr. Oz on the phone and we're talking. And it turns out that instead of putting money into this, they're thinking... They're thinking that if they add some alternative things, they can charge the patients even more money.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
And at that time, all he knew about was coenzyme Q10.
Okay.
That was all. So...
Which is a good thing to know.
Yeah. So he asked about me. I said, well, you know, I'm a science writer because I was writing about alternative medicine at the time. And I'm an energy healer, and I thought that would end the conversation, but it didn't. And he said, why don't you come in for a meeting?
Well.
So I go up to the sixth floor of Milstein, which is unlike any other place in the hospital. You sink into the carpet practically up to your knees. You
know, it's quite cushy.
Highly polished wood, frosted glass. The magazines are National Geographic and The New Yorker, indirect lighting, you know. So I go, and then I'm led to this room in back, a sort of little conference room, and there is Mehmet. I mean, this is like 1993. This tall, good-looking guy, he looks like a cross between Omar Sharif and Clark Gable.
Right.
There's the perfusionist, a guy who runs the heart-lung machine, who's interested. There's the nutritionist from Central Casting, overweight and with a bad complexion.
Uh-huh.
And there's a patient advocate. And we all sit down at the table, and we start, you know, chatting, and I, you know, put out a few ideas. And then he says, come back in a week with a suggestion of everything you think can help my patients. So I come back in a week, and the same cast of characters is there, and I start out with, feed the patients only organic foods. At which point the nutritionist spikes up. She said, oh, I don't think that's democratic. I think patients should have a choice. As if anybody ever gets what they actually order when they check off those little menu things. And then I say, then I go on, and clean the rooms with only organic cleansers. And then the patient advocate leaves over and said, Julie, if we can just get them to clean the rooms on a regular basis, we'll be ahead of the game. And Mehmet says, you know, I like your nutrition suggestion, and when I have my own hospital, we'll do that, but not now, you know. And I go down the list, and what they finally settle on is a hypnosis experiment that had been done across the town at Mount Sinai Hospital and had been so successful they finally broke the blind, you know, and put every patient on it. So they decide to do this hypnosis experiment with first-time coronary bypass patients with no complications.
All right.
So I think, fine, and I'm leaving the room, and Mehmet pulls me on the side and said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, what do you mean, what am I going to do? You asked me for my advice, I've given your advice. He said, no, what are you going to do? So I say, okay, I'll do energy healing on the patients. He said, you cannot say you're doing energy healing. They will throw you out of the hospital. I said, all right, Mehmet, I'll do energy evaluations on the patients, okay? He said, well, that doesn't sound too dangerous. So we set up this routine.
This is 93?
This is 93. Uh-huh. I come in every Wednesday. He gives me a list of patients. But I bring my cousin Michael, who has studied energy healing, my friend Michelle, who has studied energy healing, you know, and they kind of wait in the wings. And I go in with Mehmet, and he leans over the patient. He said, this is my colleague, Miss Motz. And she does... And literally, he literally mumbles. So I can't understand what he's saying in the patient.
That is fantastic.
And he says, would that be all right with you? And the patient looks up at this tall, good-looking guy who has just saved their life, or will just save their life. And they say, oh, yes, Dr. Oz, that will be just fine. And he walks out of the room with his white coat flapping behind him. I motion my friend and my cousin to come in. And the patient looks at me terrified and says, what are you going to do to me? And I say, we're going to touch you and make you feel better. And this is great news, because since they've arrived in the hospital, no one has done anything but poke them and make them feel worse.
Yeah.
So we start doing, and this is the thing the cardiologists hate, the sound of this, we start doing what used to be called energy chelations,
mm-hmm.
which basically is you run energy from the foot to the ankle to the knee to the hip to the shoulder, and then you put your hands on the various chakras, which in Indian medicine is believed to be centers of energy.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. And the patients would feel great. You know, they would do that. And so, you know, I was doing that for a while. And then, you know, I was working on one patient.
So you would do this individually or as a team?
We would do this as a team.
A team.
And
so
then,
you had like two people?
Yeah.
One on each side, one at the other.
And, but eventually, they kind of got tired, so I was just going in on my own. So there was a patient who had had a heart transplant, and I had seen him a couple of times. And the third time I came, you know, his wife said, you know, he always feels so wonderful after you work, Julie, but then he goes into depression the next day. So as I'm driving home, because I was living in the Hudson Valley, you know, about an hour and a half away from the hospital, I'm thinking, it suddenly occurred to me, well, maybe Mrs. Old Heart just popped into my mind. So the next time I saw him, I said, do you miss your old heart? He broke into tears, and he said, of course I do. I said, okay, so we'll do a little ceremony to handle that. I said, you know, first of all, I want you to say goodbye to your old heart.
And I feel my heart right now.
And I want you to thank it for all the work it's done, keeping you alive, all the love, all the fierceness. I want you to thank it and let it go. And I want you to know that if there is a heaven for hearts, your heart has certainly gone there. And now I want you to think about the new heart. You know, if it weren't for you, this heart would have no life whatsoever. You've given it a whole new life. And I want you to welcome it in your body. You know, and I put my hand on the area of the heart and around the tissue around the heart. You know. By the end, the wife and the daughter had fallen asleep. So I know. But when I came back the next week, he was very perky. And she said, well, he now has two marriages. He's married to me and he's married to his heart. And I discovered that in the successful transplants, the cells around the new heart do start producing DNA that is similar to the heart. That there really is a marriage. There really is a marriage.
Interesting. Is that like the pericardium area? Or?
No, because it's where they graft it. They graft it onto, they graft it to the back of the old heart. And to the aorta.
Oh, okay.
You know, that, you know, they have to get all the
plumbing. So there's still some heart tissue left in there?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So then I got very curious. So I thought, if I can be effective before and after surgery, could I be effective in surgery? I got curious. And I was curious about what happened. So I proposed this to Mehmet, and he said, yeah, sure. And the next week he said, no, you can't do that. You need floor IRB. IRB is Institutional Review Board. They have to review all things. There's no such thing as floor IRB, that a particular floor, like the fourth floor, the operating floor, has to have, you know. And in large medical centers, the surgeons run the floor.
Exactly. I was going
to
say.
If they want to bring a reporter into the operating room, whoever they want to bring there. So he had just made this up.
Yeah.
He just completely made this up because
he
got scared. But he had a favorite patient, a former Navy SEAL, who had come in through the emergency room and had gotten a mechanical heart implant called an LVAD, left ventricle. And he said, I want you to go see this guy. He's in the ICU. He hasn't slept for 48 hours. So I go see this guy. And the first thing is I'm very impressed because he's got the television turned off. And usually they can never get the nurses to turn off the television. So we chat a little, and I just put my hands on his feet. And he relaxes, and he falls asleep, you know. So he's very excited about this. And when I come back to see him the next
week... Because he hadn't slept for 48 hours.
He hadn't slept for 48 hours. No. When I come back the next week, I started thinking, I said, you know, would you like me to be in the operating room when your new heart comes in? He said, I would love it. I said, well, you talk to Dr. Oz.
There you go. Get the patient.
I'll talk to Dr. Oz. So the next time I saw them, but I said, you know, when Mr. So-and-so's heart comes in, I would really like to be there in the operating room. He said, what does the patient say? I said, well, he's in favor of it. Go talk to him. So that's how I ended up finally working in heart transplant
interesting.
Surgery.
Yeah. Wow. That's so fascinating. I know that, like, in Chinese medicine, you probably know. So it's interesting that you say that in heart surgery, when the old heart's removed, there's part of it that's left in there.
They attach it to the back of the heart.
I see.
Yeah, the back of the old heart.
And so there's a structure that actually surrounds the heart. It's called the pericardium.
Yes, and in some cases, they cut it open and never repair it, which I'm really horrified of because the pericardium has a very important function.
Yeah.
But in some open heart surgery, they cut into it and they never put it together again, and sometimes they do. And I don't know what that decision is based on.
So I know that in the acupuncture training I've had, the pericardium is also called circulation sector, the heart protector.
Mm-hmm.
And so the heart is considered to be the seat of love and unconditional love. And it's just open and it's like a little kid that's just like full of energy and love. And
I think that's a complete wrong interpretation of the heart.
Okay, but at any rate, so the pericardium, though, surrounds it to protect it from hard and difficult emotions that come in. So it's open and then it'll close if like it's a toxic environment or something to keep the heart from getting energetically hit. And so the pericardium accumulates a lot of negative energy and stuff like that. And if you don't clear that, then it can be a repository of emotional energy. And so the fact that they maybe leave some of that in there, and there was the person who had the heart replaced, and he was still feeling depressed in that connection. So it was sort of like you were healing the pericardial energy by helping him, like, thank it and, you know, releasing this and taking that energy and externalizing it in some fashion. And this is how I'm interpreting this.
I have a completely different take on it. Uh-huh. I think each chamber of the heart carries a different emotion.
Oh, interesting.
And the heart actually has all four emotions in it.
All four? Only four?
Well, there are actually eight, because you need different emotions depending on whether you're in safety and danger. But there are four basic actions. So the
Which are?
Oh, perception, action, understanding, and connection.
Oh, and those are emotions?
No, those are activities, but the emotions give you the energy to perform those activities.
I see. Which are the four emotions?
Fear and excitement, anger and desire, pain and satisfaction, need and love.
Okay, could you repeat those one more time, okay, slowly?
So the emotions of perception are fear and excitement.
Perception.
In danger, you perceive with fear. In safety, you perceive with excitement. The emotions of action are anger and desire. In danger, you act with anger. In safety, you act with desire. The emotions of understanding are satisfaction and pain. In danger, when you've been attacked, pain tells you what you've lost. If you've succeeded through your desire in getting what you want, you feel satisfaction. The emotions of connection are need and love. In danger, you connect with need. You reach out to get help. In safety, you connect with love. You reach out to share yourself.
Oh, wow. That is so fascinating.
And if you go...
Is that in your book also? Is that your concept?
That's not in my book. No. That's in the next book.
Okay.
And if you look at the chambers of the heart, the upper left, the left atrium takes in, it's like perception, it takes in oxygenated blood. The lower ventricle, which is one that fails most often, is the chamber of action. It sends the blood out to the body to give oxygen to everything. The upper right, the right atrium, brings information. It's like understanding from all over the body back to the heart, so the brain can sample it. And the lower right chamber, the right ventricle, sends the deoxygenated blood, the blood with the waste gases, to the lungs to go out into the air, so information about you is being sent out. So it's perception, action, understanding and connection, and each chamber of the heart has a different function.
Fascinating.
And the idea of the heart being center of love, when we say, you know, the word, in the French word is cœur, from courage, when we say take heart, we don't mean be loving, we mean be bold, we mean follow that left ventricle, which is the largest and most powerful chamber.
So this concept is something you came up with?
Yes.
I like it.
Thank you.
It's very, very fascinating. That's why we wanted you to repeat it for the podcasting audience, because it's like brilliant.
Thank you.
And so in the work that you were doing, so I think we left, did we leave off with the guy who had the mechanical left ventricle?
Who was going to have the heart transplant to replace the mechanical heart, the LVAD,
And so you were in, that was the first time you were actually in the surgical suite?
Well, no, it was a little more complicated than that, because I thought that the same people were there all the time. I didn't realize that anesthesiologists rotate and nurses rotate and technicians rotate. So I said, well, ma'am, but I don't want to just go in. I'd like to go in and meet people, you know, and sort of so they know me and I know them. Well, he said, fine, I'm going to cut skin in half an hour. So he, you know, took me to the dressing room, showed me how to pinch the mask, you know, and he was doing a coronary bypass. And they were using the vein from the leg. So I go in and I stand in front of the anesthesiologist, and I see, you know, the assisting the resident sort of waving this thing. It looks like a worm, but I know it's got to be. And I hear the vein screaming in terror. I mean, screaming. And then I hear the brain saying, nobody told me about this, nobody told me about this, nobody told me about this. And I look around and nobody seems to notice anything. Whereas I'm hearing this cacophony. And the next thing I know, I'm very, very dizzy. And I say, Mehmet, you know, I I'm not feeling so well. He said, get her a chair, get her a chair. I said, no, I have to leave the room. So with somebody carrying me, you know, putting their arms under my armpits and...
You're fainting, yeah.
Yes, I was fainting at the sight of blood. Mm-hmm. So I was very, very upset about this because I didn't know what to do because I told this guy I was going to be there for his heart transplant surgery, but I thought I'm going to be passed out underneath the operating table. So somebody said to me, don't worry, the first time I passed out, I sat on a rolling stool and zooming across the arm, we'll desensitize you. I thought, what, is Nemeth going to stand over a body waving a scalpel and I'm going to get closer and closer? But I thought, well, they'll desensitize me. But 2 days later, I get this call in the middle of the night saying, Mr. So-and-so's heart has come in, can you be here? So I'm driving and driving and thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to say? I have a flat tire, you know. And so what I decide I'm going to do is I'm just going to look at the ceiling the whole time. I'm not going to look down at the chest. And I can just say I'm getting inspiration from the heavens. And nobody's ever seen an energy healer in an operating room before. So I go in, you know, and, you know, I hold the patient's hand and I talk to him. And, you know, I watch the anesthesiologist ram the tube down the throat, which they always do. And I have my hands on the patient's head and I'm just staring at the ceiling. And I look down very quickly and I look up. Is when the scalpel makes the first incision. And then I kind of smell the barbecue smell of using the torch. And I look down and I look up. And then somehow, because I'd given myself permission not to look, I could look.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But something very strange happens. Well, first of all, there's this usual battle between the implanting and the explanting surgeon. The implanting surgeon wants them to wait as long as possible to explant the heart from the dead body.
Oh, okay.
Because they want the heart
to be super fresh.
Yeah, so, you know, it's like, and then there's the whole, so, you know, so he's saying, no, don't do it yet, don't do it. And then, of course, there's the wait, you know, did the driver stop to get pizza? What's going on? Why isn't the heart? And finally the heart arrives. But I noticed that when he went to finally attach the heart, I got an image of the patient with his hands over his head like that, you know, like, and I couldn't figure out what was going on, you know, I just thought, you know, as if he were fending off blows. You know, so I just, you know, just sort of make a mental note of that, and they finish the surgery, and I, you know, stagger home several hours later. And I come back a few days later to see the patient, and they say, well, we hope you can help because the blood pressure has been dropping precipitously. So I go in, and I see the patient, I put my hands on his feet, and I said, you know, first of all, I tell him that, you know, I got this image of the hand. He said, oh, well, I was a quarterback in football in college, and I got beaten up a lot. I said, oh, okay, that explains that. And then all of a sudden, I get an image of a dog. And I said, did you have a dog when you were a kid? He said, yes. I said, what happened to it? He said, my parents gave it away without telling me, and he burst into tears. Hmm. And I said, you know, you can't keep the story of your life from your heart. Your new heart needs to know all about you. And it particularly needs to know about the rough things and the sadness, you know. So this is what I'm going to suggest you do. I want you to take a deep breath, and in a little child's voice, I want you to say... Oh, I said, what was the dog's name? He said, it was King. So I said, the dog's name was King.
Ken?
King.
King.
Yeah. So I said, in a little voice, I want you to say... Goodbye, King. So he took a deep breath, you know, and yes, he would say, goodbye, King. Goodbye, King. And he was sobbing and sobbing and sobbing. And I said, okay, George, when I leave, I want you to tell the whole story of your heart, of your life to your heart, you know, particularly the sad places. And when I came back in a week, they said his blood pressure had stabilized that day. And he told me he had stayed up all night telling the story of his life to his heart.
So. Great stories. Are those in your book?
Yeah.
Those are in your book? Fantastic. So people, go buy the book. So how long did you do that work then?
I worked in open heart surgery because I left after I got my master's for about 2 years.
Mm-hmm. And then by then it had spread across all the... hospitals.
Yeah, I wish. No, what happened was I had asked for some funding for this, and they said, go get your own funding. So I had a friend who had a family foundation that funded cancer research. Mm. And so I got a grant to work with women having surgery for breast cancer.
Oh.
And then I switched over, and then Columbia got very angry, and they said, "Well, you didn't take a third off for our overhead." So I thought, "You told me to go out and get my own money. There is no overhead. There's just me. You know, what are you complaining about?" So I started working with breast cancer patients instead. And I also worked, because I had interviewed him for a paper I was writing, I worked with the head of neurosurgery. I did some brain surgery work.
Oh, wow.
Oh, and I worked, and one of my professors was having a knee surgery, so I worked in his surgery. So I worked in orthopedic surgery, too.
Wow. So so you've worked in cardiac and breast cancer.
Oh, and also there was somebody, I worked in a pancreatic cancer surgery. There was another surgeon. I don't even remember how I met him. Maybe I was interviewing him for a paper I was writing. So I worked with his patient. Yeah.
So those were papers you were writing as part of your master's?
Yes.
Yeah. And you didn't ever do a PhD?
No, I was so glad to get out of there. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, a lot of people go into school and it's just like totally the wrong thing to do, but you persist and you get your master's, whatever.
At the end of the semester, the professor would say, "It was so interesting to have you in the class, Miss Mons."
And you were a valedictorian?
I don't think so. Not that I can remember.
So that's fascinating. So so you're still doing that kind of energy work?
I'm not working in surgery anymore. If a friend needs it, I will prepare a friend for surgery. But I don't want to go in the operating room anymore. I originally came to California because I had grants from two different foundations to work with 30 women having surgery for breast cancer.
Oh.
And I was so burned out after the first 20 that I gave the second foundation's money back, and they were furious because they had wanted me to do that, but I just couldn't do it anymore.
And so you start by holding the feet of people?
No. What I do, first of all, is I take people through the surgery step by step, making positive associations with everything that's going to happen to them. For instance, an open heart. Well, in general, you get a muscle relaxant, so the nerves fire and the muscles don't respond. So I say, don't panic. This is like the first 3 months in utero before all the motor neurons hooked up with the bundles of muscle cells. So your body knows this. It will just go back there and enjoy it, you know. So I would do that. And then it suddenly struck me that if the relationship of the normal patient to doctor is child to parent, as it is, the relationship of the surgical patient is fetus to parent. I'm sorry, I meant child to parent is fetus to parent. And that's because in surgery, somebody breathes for you. In open heart surgery, your blood travels out of your body and back again like fetal circulation. And so if the patients were interested, I would also do a prenatal regression. Because I would say, you're very likely, because of state-dependent memory, you're very likely to go back here during the surgery. So let's see if there's any prenatal trauma that we can work on before the surgery so we can be sure you don't get re-traumatized and that just becomes a healing opportunity.
Wow, that's deep. That's very interesting reframing.
Yeah, and I got even better results with my heart patients when I did that.
Hmm.
Quicker recovery time.
Also, the heart is not beating until you're born.
No, it actually starts to beat
three weeks
after conception, which is very interesting because that's when a woman misses her first period and knows she might be pregnant, and that has a profound effect on the development of the heart. And every
patient,
how a woman reacts to knowing she's pregnant.
Oh.
And all of my heart patients were unplanned pregnancies.
Hmm. So the patient was an unplanned pregnancy.
Yes.
I see.
So apparently their mothers were not thrilled by the news that they were pregnant. Just at the time, those heart cells were just starting to beat.
Fascinating. Wow. Is this something that you came up with?
Yes.
Wow, you're brilliant.
Thank you.
It's like connecting all that with the fetus and the state-dependent of memory and emotional memory. That's very profound. Very profound. So I mentioned something about some books I've written about the brain and Alzheimer's and things like that. And you said you had something.
An unpopular opinion.
What's your unpopular opinion?
I think it's just denial carried on for decades. So if you as a child have to forget trauma that happened to you and tell yourself it didn't happen, eventually it takes over more and more of the brain. Forget, 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 forget. Hmm. And that's my very simple theory.
Hmm. Now, you've also done hypnotherapy training and all?
No.
But when I do regression, yeah,
it's sort of like putting people into a trance. I relax them first. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I've done a lot of hypnotherapy training and stuff like that, and a lot of that, the reframing and all, reminds me. Have you studied neuro-linguistic programming? Or?
I did. I found it really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So a number of the things that you're talking about, sort of reframing things, fits in with that particular technique or way of describing it.
So if Alzheimer's patients would have the courage and the time and the support to go back and deal with their early trauma, I don't think they would be so forgetful.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So,
but it's a very unpopular opinion. And I'll tell you one of the reasons. My father had a form of dementia, I don't know, and he would like, when the family was around, but he was helping his caregiver with her calculus homework.
Yeah.
So he never seemed to forget a mathematical formula. He was a physicist, I should say. Yeah. You know. So, but somehow with the family and with all the emotional stuff, then he would get foggy.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Well, certainly, people with dementia, Alzheimer's, things in their past they remember really well, or there's connection with music.
Yeah.
But
they don't remember the traumatic things from their past very well.
Perhaps not. Perhaps not. That's so interesting. And so, where are...
And I think that's true of dementia in general, not just Alzheimer's.
Uh-huh. Where are the seats of memory in the body?
They're all over the body. They're all over the body. I mean, that's what, you know, that was the great discovery when they were doing of Rolfing, essentially, that the body could hold memories.
Mm-hmm.
How that works, how that mechanism works, I don't know.
You haven't come up with your theory yet.
Well, I have a general theory that the brain says, I'm too busy, you handle it.
Hmm. Meaning some other part of the body? Or?
Yeah, don't bring this up to consciousness. Don't bring this up to consciousness. Don't bring this up to consciousness. Just stay down there so I can keep running the world.
Right. So is it a function of the brain, though?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's a kind of joking, imagined conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that somehow the being decides it's not safe to have conscious knowledge of this. And when somebody suddenly has a bad knee or bad arm, I think the body is saying, look, you're forcing me to hold this memory for you and function as an arm as well. At some point, I'm going to have to give up functioning as an arm if you're not going to bring this up into consciousness.
Hmm. So it's actually, it's a memory that is... Is it partially a function of the brain, or is it the brain and like the arm in combination, or is it just the arm?
I think it's in combination.
Yeah.
I think it's in combination.
Okay. Yeah, because memory is a very, very fascinating subject in my own...
Do you know what I wish people would study? Memory suppression.
Hmm.
There's a lot of study on memory retrieval. There's very little work on how does a memory get suppressed. And I think if we did that, then we could reverse engineer that and bring the memories to the surface, but... I've searched for research on that.
Mm. That's interesting. I know that like in neuro-linguistic programming, there are these timeline techniques that are used. Like if someone has an accident, and I've used this in my clinical practice when it's relevant. But someone has an accident, and that the residuals and the pain and all these different patterns that started from that accident continue to create obstacles to their life. And so one starts, has the person go back like 5 minutes before the accident. Remember what that was like. Mm-hmm. And then you slowly go through the whole accident until like 5 minutes after it's finished.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start over again, mm-hmm, 5 minutes before. And you go through that, the person does it, not mm-hmm the person. And then they go through that until it's very easy to get that whole sequence together.
Mm-hmm.
Then they start 5 minutes after it and they go in reverse, back through the sequence until everything was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start again after it's happened, and you go in reverse. And then once that's easy to go in reverse, then you go forward, mm-hmm, reverse, forward, reverse, forward, reverse, and then you think of something different. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that is sufficient to, perhaps it is a clearing of the memory, or that it's at least disrupting the pattern memory, yeah, such that it can't, at least one, it can't go in the sequence like that computer program. Something's in there that all of a sudden takes it off in a different direction, and it can't complete the pattern. Mm-hmm. And then you don't have that whole like gestalt of the pain and everything that had occurred through the accident. Anyway, that's how I look at it.
I think that's fine. But if you don't go with a history of that part of the body, the person will probably injure themselves again in a similar way.
If you don't go through what?
If you don't get to the history of what made that part of the body vulnerable to injury to begin with, mm-hmm, I think the person will probably injure themselves again.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking in terms of like car accidents and stuff. And so, is it that particular part of the body that caused the car accident?
Sometimes it is.
Yeah.
Or sometimes the body selected which part it was going to put forward to get wounded.
Ah, interesting. Interesting. So, currently, what are you doing as far as in your life? I mean, I know you. I don't want to blow confidentiality. Okay. But
I'm continuing to see patients. Mm-hmm. Not in the operating room. Or no. I host two radio shows, as you mentioned. I'm working on a memoir.
Oh, nice.
I'm also trying to get. I want to do a book. All right, this is a little complicated. My work with emotions has led me to a belief that there are four emotional types, and each one finds a certain emotion easy and another emotion difficult, and they marry their opposite. Okay. But this means that when you talk to your partner, you have to use language that is the opposite of what you want to hear yourself. And so I've been thinking of doing a book called Love Language, mm-hmm, which coaches people about what kinds of language to use depending on, you know, what type of partner you have. I've just been tossing that around in my head. Mm-hmm. The other thing,
there is this concept called love languages.
I know love languages, yeah, but this is not love languages. This is the specific words, uh-huh, that you use. Love language has to do with, like, touch, do you like gestures?
Right.
Yeah.
Gifts, presents.
But I've postponed this for a long time. I want to start doing tapes for people to prepare them for surgery, because the tapes that are out now are just very general. But I would like to take the 10 most common surgeries and give people very specific tapes to listen to, mm-hmm, to prepare for those surgeries and to recover from those surgeries. Mm-hmm. And finally, I've started another business called Poetry by Choice, in which I write poems and rap songs for people.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
So, have you ever heard of bank code?
No.
Bank? So there's a system called Bank, B-A-N-K, Blueprint Action Nurturing Knowledge, and I've been trained in it. It's, okay, it's a personality assessment process.
Yes.
We use four cards.
Okay.
Because it's very easy. I won't do this online with you, but it reminds me a little bit of your four emotions.
Uh-huh.
And based on which particular personality type is your dominant or your second or your last, mm-hmm, those are the types of, they are the way that one tends to operate and behave and speak in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But if the person that you're communicating with isn't in alignment with that, then it's better to know what their language is.
Yes.
And use their language to improve the communication.
Yes, absolutely. Well,
so that's very similar to your, yeah, four emotions. So yeah, I like that idea.
Well, we live in a quadripartite universe, four dimensions of space and one of time.
Is it only that?
Only four letters needed for DNA, for all the complexity of DNA.
Mm-hmm. Four is a very powerful number.
Space, time, energy, and matter. There isn't anything else in the universe.
True, but if you... Astrophysicists and others who are trying to come up with the Holy Grail of putting all of the equations that have to do with predicting of you know, gravity, all these different things, and the quantum physics, etc. They're separate. They're separate equations.
Well, they're not completely separate. They've unified the weak force in electromagnetism. Glashow and Weinberg came up with that. I think they got the Nobel Prize for that, maybe like 20 years ago, even, mm-hmm, longer. So they've managed to unify equations to unify two forces.
Right.
But not gravitation and the strong force.
Right. So two are unified, but not all of them are, and there are various attempts to bridge those. And my understanding is string theory is one possible mathematical theory and way to try to jump across all those.
I think they should study human emotions if they want to figure it out. Because I also believe that each emotion corresponds, each pair of emotions corresponds to a different force in physics.
Okay.
And in fact, the reason we like physics is that our emotions are our experience of those forces.
Hmm.
So when you're feeling frightened or excited, your electromagnetic field increases. When you're feeling angry or filled with desire, your gravitational field increases. When you're feeling deeply satisfied or in pain, your nuclear field increases. And when you're in love or need, your weak force field increases. But of course, I haven't gotten a physicist to measure this yet, so.
Wow, that's very interesting, because I studied physics a fair amount. And one of the things that I grasped onto at one point was the multidimensionality of reality. And so I think string theory suggests there's 10 or 23, the numbers keep changing, how many dimensions have to exist for all of this to work properly. And so from that standpoint, I think there might be more than just the four dimensions.
I think four dimensions are sufficient.
On that note, how can people get in touch with you if they want to? I mean, we will have the information on our website.
Well, my email address is jamtoday, JAMTODAY,
all right,
at juliemotz.com.
At juliemotz.com. Fantastic. So jamtoday at juliemotz.com.
It comes from the Alice Through the Looking Glass at the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. Mm. The March Hare asks for jam, and the Mad Hatter says, you know the rule, jam yesterday or jam tomorrow, but never jam today. Well, my initials are J-A-M, Julie Ann Motz, so I am Jam Today.
I love it. Thank you very much for being part of this podcast.
Thank you for asking such great questions and making it so easy and so much fun.
It was fun. Thanks.
To buy your copy of Superbrain, maximize your brain health for a better life, go to superbrain-thebook.com. That's superbrain-thebook.com. Information can also be found on naturalsolutionswithdrj.com.